started recently. So far, two homes have been destroyed, Johnson told CNN by phone. Monsoon season has arrived in the West, bringing with it mudslides, flash flooding, and dust storms. The monsoon moisture moving into the region could potentially stomp out some fires and quench the dry vegetation and soil, but it could also cause more dangerous conditions. Lightning and high fire danger will likely result in new fire starts. Gusty thunderstorm winds could contribute to fire spread. Despite rainfall, initial attack resources could be overwhelmed and holdover fires are possible, said the National Weather Service office in Medford, Oregon. Red flag warnings are in place across central and eastern Oregon for the weekend, where the potential for thunderstorms has drawn out worries for more fire starts. With the Bootleg fire already blistering over 400,000 acres of the Oregon Hills, lightning and strong winds from monsoon thunderstorms could start more fires, further straining resources. The rainfall might help control some fires in the region, but left behind will be the scorched earth that is prone to runoff and flash flooding. The United States isn't the only country experiencing serious wildfires. For the second straight day, more than 1,100 people have been evacuated by sea from the tourist hotspot of Bodrum to escape Turkey's forest fires burning along the Mediterranean coast. We held the evacuation of 1,140 people by 12 boats. Oran Dine, president of Bodrum Maritime Chamber, told CNN on August 2nd. We did evacuation by boats yesterday as well, but I never witnessed something similar before in this region. This is the first time, a witness said. Dine said, while roads remain open and evacuations continue by land, evacuations by sea help keep roads open for fire trucks and ambulances. The death toll in Turkey's forest fires along the Mediterranean coast has increased to at least 8 people killed on Sunday, August 2nd, according to state-run Anadolu agency. The latest victims include a Turkish-German couple who were found in a house. According to the Turkish Agriculture and Forestry Ministry, 111 fires have started across the country since July 28. 6 fires are still burning in 3 different cities, the ministry said.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Let's focus on the laws of Homs. According to the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, we are working on the laws of Homs or related to Homs, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And let me start this episode with this interesting question. There is a student who wishes to get married. So he intends to purchase domestic appliances for his future life or marital life. So he starts now to purchase household appliances and equipment, and a year passes on or on them, the equipment, without being used, okay?
Sure.
So should he pay their homes or the Homs doesn't apply to the appliances that he's, let's say, saving for his future marital life?
That's a good question. According to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, if buying domestic appliances, like those things you mentioned in the question, is considered in common view, in the eye of urf or custom, as a part of your annual expenses, okay, then khums is not liable for khums is not liable, and khums is not paid on those appliances which a person, for example, or a student purchases, because let's consider, as you rightly mentioned, these are appliances are cannot be purchased in a single, for example, in one day, or they cannot be, because a person cannot afford to buy them in just in a matter of one day or 2 days. He has to buy them over a period of time, especially if he intends to, for example, to get married. It will be somewhat difficult for a student who does not have a source of income to buy such things. So he has to buy them within a period of time. And of course, in common view, such a person, in common view, of course, it's considered to be his part of his annual expenses. Annual expenses. So in that case, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, khums is not payable. And again, I have to tell you that there is a difference of opinion when it comes to Ayatollah Sistani. He's also, he's of the view that if a year passes on the purchased item, and that item remains unused for over a year, or for a year or over or more, then khums should be paid on it. It does not make any difference whether that is considered to be a part of the annual expenses or it's not considered. But if a year elapses on that item or on that purchased item, good, then khums should be paid from it.
Okay, another question would be about khums rule concerning, for example, pen, makeup, perfumes, etc., etc., that are used partially. We know that some of the stuff or some of the purchased items we have can only be used partially, not in full.
Yeah. All
right. So if a year passes on them, do we have to pay the khums? Should we pay the khums or their khums on that item that, in fact, takes up 1 year for it to pass?
Of course, as you rightly mentioned, there are things that may be used partially.
Yes.
For example, a bottle of perfume.
Yes.
Half of the perfume has been already used up, and or a pen or a pencil, things like that. Both the religious authorities, Ayatollah Khamenei and Ayatollah Sistani, are of the view that if these things, these articles, are have monetary value, khums should be paid from them, monetary value. And of course, if these things have no monetary value means that they can be sold on the market. Okay, you can just sell them, just like any other items that you sell out in the streets. You can also sell a half-used bottle of perfume or a pen or something like that. If they can be sold on the market and there are customers who buy these things, then khums should be paid from their current market value. And of course, if they are so used up and they cannot be sold, and there is no one to buy them, then they are useless, and of course khums is not paid on them because they have no monetary value.
I see. La ilaha illallah, wallahu akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
There is a student, Sheikh Javid, who fixed the first of, for example, 1 month, let's say October,
yes,
as the date of his homes year, okay?
Yeah.
So the problem is that if he saved some money to pay the tuition fees, because he's a student,
sure,
so he has to pay the tuition fees, right, for
yeah,
the university, which should be settled in the middle of, let's say, that month,
yeah,
like October, okay?
Yes.
Now, shall he pay its homes at the end of the homes year, like at the end of October? But if he does that, his tuition fees would not be paid,
mm,
all right? Because that would be like the middle of the October.
October, yes.
The month, but not at the beginning.
Well,
so what is this, the status here?
Well, the opinion of His Eminence is that in the said case in which he is supposed to pay khums in the middle of October, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, given the fact that the beginning of October is the first day of his khums
year,
but after 15 days he is supposed to pay his tuition fee, okay?
And he would be in trouble financially.
Yeah, and if he pays khums, of course, he will have difficulty paying his tuition fees, and of course that will put him into unnecessary trouble or difficulty. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, in the said case, khums is not payable on the amount which goes towards paying his tuition fees, and that amount, that money actually is not subject to khums.
Uh-huh. Okay, very good. The other question is, Sheikh Javid, if a duty bound,
yeah,
all right, using his yearly income, annual income, purchases a plot of land for housing. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So after the homes year passes on it, he sells it to buy another house or a residential house, for example, or other life requirements.
Mm.
Should he pay its homes or the homes on the proceeds?
Well, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, if he buys the plot with his yearly earnings for building a residential house on the plot, but after the khums year passes, he exchanges the very plot with a house, or actually spends its proceeds on buying another house for living in it. According to His Eminence, it's not subject to khums, nor is it considered as new earnings, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Therefore, khums is not payable on the plot or on the proceeds or on the new residential house, because maybe the plot is a piece of land he buys, but he sells that plot and he buys a residential house which he intends to use and or which he's going to use, and he needs it, of course, assuming that he does not have a house, a separate house, and that's the only place he has considered to build a house on,
mm-hmm,
and to live in. So, of course, that property or that piece of land or whatever is khums is not payable on it. And, of course, this is the opinion of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. But Ayatollah Sistani, because it's very good to draw a comparison,
yes,
between
exactly,
his view and that of Ayatollah Sistani. Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that if a person buys or purchases a piece of land, and of course, he then saves money to build that piece of land,
mm-hmm,
to build a house on that piece of land, khums is not payable on the amount which is saved towards building a house. Mm-hmm. But he has to buy the brick, the plot, and then the brick. And step by step, he will build a house until a house is built completely.
Yes.
Khums is not payable on that building. But if he saves money and a year passes on that amount of money, on a year, mm-hmm. without him taking any action to buy a plot or a house, then he has to pay khums on it because a year has already passed on that saving.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
More than 15 million American renters are at risk of eviction without backup as a ban on residential evictions expired on Saturday at midnight. Early Sunday, some Democratic lawmakers rallied outside the Capitol to call for the ban's reinstatement. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention ordered the moratorium to fight the spread of the COVID-19 and prevent homelessness during the pandemic. It came into effect in September 2020 and has been extended multiple times. The U.S. Congress had approved around $47 billion in rental relief to states during the pandemic, but the money has been slow to make it into the hands of those in need. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said only $3 billion out of the total allocated fund has been distributed to renters. Pelosi and other top Democrats have urged the administration of Joe Biden to extend the moratorium through October the 18th. The U.S. President Joe Biden is under fire by his own party members. The Democrats criticized Biden's inaction as the deadline neared, some furious that he called on Congress to provide a last-minute solution to protect renters. Biden had asked Congress to extend the deadline on Thursday amid the surging Delta variant, but Congress failed to act after Republican House members blocked a Democratic-led bid. The House has already left for a six-week summer recess, and it remains unclear whether the administration could extend the moratorium using executive powers.
It's a partisan issue. There's absolutely no difficulty with the United States providing the money to their own citizens to enable them to pay their rental commitments. And it's something I argued back in March of 2020, where it's absolutely necessary, because if you're going to fight the virus, you have to enable people to stay at home. If they stay at home, they can't earn an income, so they must be given a cash flow to cover their outgoings, so you don't get people being made homeless courtesy of fighting a pandemic.
Pressure is mounting on U.S. lawmakers to extend a moratorium that barred landlords from evicting certain tenants who could not pay rent during the pandemic. This put millions of Americans at risk of being homeless amid the coronavirus pandemic. Meanwhile, top U.S. infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci has warned that the coronavirus situation in the United States is set to get worse as the country grapples with a surge in the Delta variant of the COVID-19. The U.S. is currently the worst hit nation by the pandemic. Homeless Americans could face other challenges as well. For instance, Los Angeles has approved a new law that makes it illegal for unhoused people to be in almost all places across the city. If you become homeless in LA, that's the fair fate that awaits you. That's why the latest city count shows LA has over 66,000 homeless people.
And it shows the extent to which the American political system uses its own people as a bargaining chip, or a shuttlecock in this battle between the two ruling parties. So it's utterly unnecessary and will be very damaging. And again, it's a sign of just how divided America is these days that this is being allowed to happen.
The expiration of the U.S. eviction ban could send millions of people out on the streets. Then they're faced with the threat of the coronavirus and hunger. Currently, around 40 million low-income Americans rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program to stay out of hunger. It seems the U.S. politicians are more interested in spending money on wars and U.S. military bases and adventures around the world instead of their own people. An Israeli petroleum products tanker managed by Israeli-owned Zodiac Maritime came under attack off the coast of Oman on Thursday. The London-based company later claimed that two crewmen, a Briton and a Romanian, had been killed in the assault. The US, Israel and their allies rushed to point the finger at Iran for the attack, while the official investigation has only begun and is not completed yet. Meanwhile, a source close to the resistance axis said the attack on the Mercer Street tanker was a retaliation for Israeli aggression in Syria, particularly the latest attack on Davao Airport that left two resistance forces dead. In recent months, several other Israeli ships have been targeted in various maritime routes across the world. Earlier in the month, a fire broke out on an Israeli-owned cargo ship after it was struck by an unidentified weapon in the northeastern Indian Ocean. Back in February, an Israeli-owned ship was hit by an explosion in the Sea of Oman. In April, another Israeli ship came under attack off the coast of the UAE.
Resistance access won't permit the Israelis to commit any crimes without retaliation, whether from the Yemen or Lebanon or Syria or Palestine or Tehran or any place of the resistance axis. So I guess they have to expect that the resistance forces can reach them anywhere. So they are playing a losing game with the resistance axis, whether when they attack at Syrian borders or the Iraq-Syrian borders or at Tehran when they commit assassinations or do any aggressions against this power. Now the balance of power is for the sake or for the interest of the access of resistance.
The retaliatory attack has exposed the vulnerability of Israeli entities in the region and sent a strong message to Israel that the resistance front will not allow the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with impunity. Western countries have condemned the latest attack on the Israeli-owned ship off the Oman coast, while they have always shut their eyes to Israel's crimes. Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011, and millions more are suffering due to the crippling sanctions and economic war imposed on Syria by the U.S. government. That's while Washington's ally, the occupying regime of Israel, has attacked Syria on a continual basis. Also, the Syrian government blames the Israeli regime and its Western regional allies for aiding Takfiri terrorist groups wreaking havoc in the country. The latest attacks on Israeli ships come against the backdrop of Tel Aviv's various assaults on cargo ships across the Persian Gulf region and elsewhere. A Wall Street Journal report in March revealed that Israel had systematically struck at least 12 Iranian ships. Israel is also responsible for several instances of acts of sabotage against Iran's nuclear program over the past decade, including attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and assassination of its scientists.
A root cause of the tension, the deplorable level of tension in the Middle East that the world has been witness to for many decades now, is the fact that Israel acts with impunity. Israel is given a blank check, so to speak, year on year from Washington and London to do as it pleases in the Middle East. If America and Britain truly respected international law, if they truly respected the Charter of the United Nations, and if they truly respected the concept of state sovereignty, then they would put an end to Israel's flagrant violations of international law.
The international community's silence in the face of Tel Aviv's crimes is a result of the U.S. shielding of the illegitimate regime of Israel. Tel Aviv has for long been able to get away with its crimes without any prosecution. However, the latest move by the resistance axis shows that Tel Aviv's hit-and-run tactic is no longer useful. Now it must face the music and taste its own medicine.
On Thursday, Israel attained observer status at the African Union after nearly 20 years of lobbying. Making the move official, Israeli ambassador to Ethiopia, Burundi, and Chad presented his credentials to Moussa Faki Mohammed, the chairman of the African Union Commission, at the bloc's headquarters in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
But for African countries, Palestine is now no longer a priority. Unfortunately, for some Arab countries that have turned their back to Palestine, this is the same.
The move was met with harsh criticism from Palestinian resistance groups and several African nations. In a letter to the chairperson of the African Union, head of Hamas political wing Ismail Haniyeh said the decision contradicts the principles of the organization. He added that the move deals a heavy blow to the Palestinian people and their legitimate rights. Haniyeh called on Faki to reverse the decision, indicating that it does not reflect the truth of the stance of the Union toward the Palestinian cause. South Africa also fiercely objected to the move by the Union. It said the AU Commission made the decision unilaterally without consulting its members.
Now, none of the member states were officially consulted, except those that are probably pro-Israeli. The pro-Israeli ones are well known. It's Kenya, Tanzania, it's Rwanda, Togo, Cameroon. These are the countries that are backing this move.
The South African Foreign Ministry has called the AU's move, quote, incomprehensible and inexplicable. The the South African government said the African Union's decision is even more shocking in a year in which oppressed people of Palestine were hounded by destructive bombardments and continued illegal settlements of the land. It was referring to Israel's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip in May that killed over 250 Palestinians, including 66 children. The war broke out after the regime's decision to evict several Palestinian families from their homes in the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah.
Now, South Africa has been preceded by Algeria, and in Algeria a week ago was up in arms at this decision without having been consulted, and said it was contrary to the charter of the African Union, that the charter does not allow apartheid states, a state that practices racism as its official policy, to be part of as an observer, and that commits atrocities against an occupied population. And today, Namibia has joined South Africa.
Israel previously held observer status in the predecessor organization of African Unity until 2002, when the organization was disbanded and replaced by the AU. Pro-Palestine language is typically featured in statements delivered at the AU's annual summits. Palestine already has observer status at the African Union. Besides, the United States, Israel's closest ally, also operates in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism there. However, local sources say civilians have been the main victims of the attacks conducted by U.S. forces.
In fact, even in southern, on the southern border of Syria, in the Quneitra region, Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra, who are a terrorist organization fighting against the Syrian government, have been assisted, aided both militarily, financially, logistically by Israel. So, I mean, this is, of course, just diplomatic talk.
That underlines the risk for Africa to have a possible Israeli military presence, as the Israeli regime is already facing a probe over war crimes committed in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank.
Ties between the United States and Russia are far worse than strained. The two have been on a confrontational path for a very long time. Tensions have been deteriorating over the past years after a series of tit-for-tat actions that have left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Such tit-for-tat actions, like consulate closures or expulsions of diplomats, have made it difficult to even conduct basic bilateral diplomacy. The lack of proper diplomatic contacts between the two rivals has increased the risk of miscalculation that could lead to a potential disaster. Recently, Russia's top diplomat warned that tensions between Washington and Moscow were getting close to a dangerous confrontation. The two sides say they want to prevent any such scenario. This week, diplomats from the U.S. and Russia sat down for talks on strategic stability. The talks in Geneva were arranged in June when U.S. President Joe Biden met his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. Moscow and Washington have deep differences over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. Observers believe such differences have their roots in the geopolitical rivalry between the two major nuclear-armed states.
I think that what's happened in the last 20 years under Putin's basic leadership, I think for the last 20 years, has been a resurgence of Russian power, of Russian technology, of the place of Russia in the world. And as a major country, the United States doesn't like that.
Can the ongoing diplomatic effort help reduce tensions and pave the way for cooperation? The meeting on Wednesday was the first in a series of planned talks aimed at enhancing communication and reduce the possibility of missteps. The delegations were headed by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman and the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov. The U.S. side called the discussions professional and substantive. The Russians said they were satisfied with the conclusions and that America showed readiness for constructive dialogue. But despite the positive signs, controversial comments by the U.S. president drew condemnation from Moscow. In an address to national intelligence officers, Joe Biden accused Russia of trying to interfere in the 2022 U.S. midterm elections. He warned that an escalation in cyber attacks could lead to war. Biden also said Russia has nuclear weapons and oil wells, and nothing else to earn money from. The U.S. president claimed this economic weakness makes Russia even more unpredictable and dangerous. The Russians were quick to respond. The Kremlin said Biden's statements showed America's erroneous understanding of modern Russia. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Moscow regrets that America is more of an adversary than a partner, despite the Russian government showing political will to normalize ties. Observers believe the latest exchanges further reveal the depth of distrust and deep differences between Washington and Moscow.
Russians have begun to reassert their normal geographic dominance in the area. And in particular, this was true with Ukraine. And, you know, so can you imagine the situation if the Russians had on the Canadian border, you know, an army? We would freak out. Well, the Russians feel the same way about NATO being in the middle of Europe now. And they felt very, very betrayed by the fact that NATO expanded, because they felt they had a deal in the 1980s with Gorbachev that wouldn't happen. And so they're upset about that and have been very clear about that.
Problems that have soured bilateral relations are many, and both sides seem unwilling to back down when it comes to strategic issues. The upcoming talks will probably show whether the two sides are serious enough to resolve their problems.
The Lies.
An aquarium in the French capital, Paris, is celebrating the birth of a baby black-tip shark. The female shark is 55 centimeters long and weighs 560 grams. She's currently quarantined in a small pond so she wouldn't come under attack by adult sharks. Officials at the aquarium say she'll be ready to swim amongst other sharks in 3 to 4 months. She was born last week at the aquarium, an event the caretakers say is very rare.
It's a rare event for us, which hadn't happened here for the past 5 years. The birth is quite rare in aquariums and in captivity in general. In fact, there are often embryos that won't survive, or they're sometimes stillborn. That's what makes it a rare event, which also occurs at night. We had the chance to observe it during the day, which allowed us to intervene very quickly, and we're able to recover the little one.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature has designated black-tip sharks as a vulnerable species. It's particularly poached in some countries for their distinctive fins. The marvelous creatures have a torpedo-shaped body and often spin out of water while eating. They have specialized cells in their snouts that detect the electric current of nearby prey.
A Turkish farmer hails the miraculous survival of two baby goats from deadly wildfires. Sergeant Bayat said seeing his livestock threatened by flames was the most difficult moment in his life. Bayat said although he lost 8 of his animals in the fire, he found new life after the survival of a newborn goat. He said the mother of the kid had been killed in a wildfire. Bayat called it a miracle. But there was also another baby goat.
We found another goat amidst the wildfire. She has a baby. There you go, miracle number 2.
Bayat says although his farm was severely damaged, he's now over the moon at the survival of the baby goats. The massive forest fire in southern Turkey broke out on Wednesday, fueled by strong winds. Wildfires are common in southern Turkey in the summer, but local authorities say the latest fires have covered a much bigger area. Last year, a powerful explosion in Beirut turned life around for thousands of Lebanese. Now, a number of people have decided to build a monument in honor of the victims of the terrible accident. 27 individuals and organizations have pooled their efforts to build a giant 25-meter sculpture at a site of last August's explosion. The artwork is called Gesture and is made out of reclaimed metal debris. It looks like it's handing a flower to the city of Beirut. When completed, Gesture will also have a water and light installation. The project was conceived and designed by Nadim Karam, one of Lebanon's most celebrated artists.
Cats are notoriously volatile animals, as we all know. One moment they are purring for your attention, and the next they can't stand being touched. Now, a Canadian firm has come up with an app that can help you better understand your feline friends. The app is called Tabby and works with artificial intelligence. The AI's algorithm was trained at a clinic in the city of Calgary. The developers of Tabby hope their product can be useful for novice cat owners and vets alike. The app can also help monitor the health of cats. Tabby's developer explains how the app functions.
It uses artificial intelligence, so specifically machine learning, and it's coupled with the feline grimace scale. And what the feline grimace scale is, it's a way for humans to be able to determine if a cat is in pain or not, based on the ear positioning, the eye positioning, the muzzle, whiskers, things like that. And so we were able to train a machine using machine learning and a series of images to be able to make that determination. So if you're somebody who has a cat but you don't have that training, you can just use the app and it can help you determine this, how your cat is doing.
Sounds very useful. The Tabby is not perfect though and runs into problems when trying to decipher the mood of black cats. Despite the hiccups, the developers say the program will get better at doing its task as its artificial intelligence develops through practice. Humans have damaged the environment, perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Known in Cyprus as Birdman, 28-year-old Konstantinos Antonio is a wildlife veterinarian. Every year, he saves hundreds of sick or wounded wild birds. The animals brought to him are usually found by regular people. Konstantinos says climate change has made the task of assisting birds more urgent as their survival becomes harder and harder. The Cypriot environmentalist usually frees the animals after treatment in the presence of other people in order to raise awareness about the issue. A vertical forest has transformed the Chinese megacity of Chengdu into a concrete jungle, making the lives of the residents greener. Each unit at the 8-tower complex has a balcony with around 20 types of luxuriant plants and greenery. The green space filters air and noise pollution while creating a spectacular view. The project in the southwestern city was completed in 2018, and all of the 826 apartments were sold out at the time.
I think it's quite good. The air quality is pretty good and much better than my old houses. The air is good when you wake up in the morning, and the green trees are good for us elderly people. They are good for our eyes.
Besides all the benefits, the apartments have a major problem. They have been overrun by plants and invaded by mosquitoes. The issue has forced some of the occupants to move out. Other cities around the world, such as New York and Copenhagen, have also launched similar green housing projects.
The best visited multimedia exhibit in the world, known as Van Gogh Live, The experience has opened in Munich after being postponed a number of times due to COVID-19.
Van Gogh is einfach der berühmteste.
Van Gogh is just the most famous artist in the world. He is also a prototype artist. He is the last artist who then tragically dies at the end. His life story was just fascinating, and that's why he is Van Gogh. And of course, his artworks are fascinating.
Featuring some of Van Gogh's best-known works, the exhibition is not only a feast for the eyes, but the senses with music and smells to accompany the colorful projections. The exhibit is supposed to smell like the countryside because of where Van Gogh lived. However, the organizers say visitors cannot really experience the feeling due to wearing masks. Van Gogh Alive, the experience was first presented in Singapore in 2011. Since then, the multimedia exhibit has been seen in 70 cities and has attracted some 6 million visitors.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Conservation measures have managed to bring the world's most endangered cat back from the brink of extinction. In 2002, there were less than 100 Iberian lynx left in the wild. The situation prompted officials in Spain and Portugal to save the animal through a captive breeding program. They also tried hard to fight poaching and reintroduce rabbits, the cat's major prey, into the wild. By the end of 2020, there were over 1,100 Iberian lynx living in the two countries, most of them in Spain's southern region of Andalusia.
The main cause of death for wildlife, certainly in the natural environment, is related to human activities, roadkill, poaching, unwanted encounters. So the less interaction they have with humans, the better.
Despite the successful measures, the International Union for Conservation of Nature still lists the animal as endangered. It's estimated that the species will be out of danger only when its population surpasses 3,000. Urban development, hunting, and roadkill are the major reasons of death for wild lynxes these days. Brazilians have come up with a creative idea to combat population, that is pollution, and global warming, repopulating mangroves. The project is aimed at reforesting an area equal to 75 football fields in Guanabara Bay. Organizers hope to make the biggest mangrove garden in a country. Mangroves, which usually grow in tropical regions, are essential to maintaining water quality and clarity. They filter and trap sediments, heavy metals, and other pollutants. Mangrove forests are also able to store 3 to 4 times more carbon than other forests.
A mesmerizing hot air balloon festival has got on the way in the U.S. state of New Jersey. The sky was littered with nearly 100 beautifully colored hot air balloons in different shapes, captivating every viewer. The awe-inspiring event brought together COVID-wary citizens to experience joy and jubilation amid health restrictions. Pleasant weather made the experience all the more enjoyable. The 38th annual New Jersey Lottery Festival of Ballooning is likely the largest outdoor entertainment event in the tri-state area since the pandemic began.
Nostalgia is in the air in Paris as streets of the city
are enlivened, enlivened, that is, with old vehicles. The French capital has hosted an annual parade called Summer Crossing of Paris. It brought together over 700 vintage cars, motorbikes, buses, and tractors from all over Europe. The route started from a Vincennes castle east of Paris and ended in the southwest of the city. Drivers crossed the iconic monuments such as the Eiffel Tower and the Arc de Triomphe.
It is extraordinary because the automobile industry heritage and the Parisian architectural heritage, which is obviously absolutely fabulous, echo each other. We are driving through all of Paris's most beautiful squares.
The 14th version of the event drew hundreds of enthusiastic visitors from across France. People were asked to wear masks and keep social distancing because of COVID-19. Tehran municipality has inaugurated an art garden that puts on display Iran's art and culture. As Youssef Jalali reports, the cultural facility aims to reconnect visitors with Iran's rich past amid increasing preoccupation with modern lives.
Sit back and enjoy the beauty of Iran's ancient culture. In Kushk Art Garden, located in the heart of Tehran, visitors get to learn about Iran's music, literature, painting, and calligraphy, far from the hustle and bustle of modern life. Kushk hosts Iranian artists who create masterpieces that have their roots in thousands of years ago.
Miniature painting has been around in Iran since thousands of years ago. In miniature, we paint flat images with a myriad of details. We avoid adding shades to make it as flat as possible, since in the past, Iranians believed that divine light gives shape to everything.
Metal engraving first stepped into existence 7,000 years ago in Iran. It is the art of incising decorations and metals. In this workshop, I will be available every day for visitors to see how I can turn metals into beautiful handicraft.
Kushk is part of a bigger project dubbed Art Garden. The cultural complex consists of an art lake, poem and literature house, music house, and Kushk Garden, each trying to promote an aspect of Iran's culture. Tehran municipality says it inaugurated the peaceful place, for it says cultural identity has been overshadowed by modern technology.
This precious place was a much-needed initiative to preserve the Iranian art and culture. As time goes by, technology gets more and more intertwined with our daily lives, and our genuine culture slips into oblivion. We need to have such cultural centers that safeguard our cultural heritage.
The Art Garden is situated on Abbasabad Hills in downtown Tehran. In recent years, the area has turned into a tourist attraction that houses structures that combine modern technology with ancient culture, such as this large pedestrian overpass called Tabiat Bridge, and the Middle East's largest planetarium, dubbed Mina Dome.
Kushk will be the last piece of Tehran's art garden, and will be a hotspot for a range of cultural activities, all aiming to revive the ancient Iranian art and culture, which experts believe have become a lost piece in today's hectic life. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palazzo Farnese is one of the most famous palaces in Rome and is being used as the French embassy. However, some of the rooms there are not open to the public. Now, an artist has come up with a creative way to show the historic building to everyone. An Italian artist known as JR has created a mural art installation on the French diplomatic mission in Rome. The artwork is equivalent to a virtual hole and shows what the building would look like if there were no outside walls. JR has conducted similar dazzling projects on other buildings, including a mural in the city of Florence, providing people with a sneak view of architectural masterpieces.
IRIB English Radio.